Welcome to Understanding VC. I am your host, Rahul. Understanding VC is a show where I talk to VCs to learn how they work. Today, my guest is Priyank Swaroop. Priyank is a partner at Axel, a global VC firm with $20 billion in assets under management, where he focuses on investments in cybersecurity, developer tools, marketplaces, and SaaS business. Prior to Axel, he worked at Adobe and Standard Chartered Bank in India and Singapore. Now, let's talk to him. So, hi, Priyank. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Rahul. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to talk to you.
So let's start with your background. Where did you grow up and what were your interests growing up?
Nobody has asked me this question such a long time. What were my interests growing up? So I grew up in this town near Delhi, the capital of India, called Ghaziabad. It's a small town in Uttar Pradesh. And it's 1 hour away from Delhi. It used to be it is still an industrial town. But I did a bunch of my schooling in Delhi and went to college in Delhi. IT Delhi, and then worked at Adobe. And interestingly, I spent 3 years in Singapore, a year working for Adobe, and then a couple of years working at Standard Chartered Bank. So Singapore was quite fun. So it's one of my favorite cities. Yeah. And in terms of interest, so what I wanted to grow up as, you know, I always wanted to be a fighter pilot. Then in sixth class, I got my specs and I was like, okay, I can't be a fighter pilot now. I didn't know whether you can be, but somebody told me you can't be. So then I said, okay, I'll become a commando. Then I realized I'm not that physically strong compared to some of the other kids. I said, okay, I'll become a scientist. So it kept on changing over the years. And then by the time I came to college, I was like, let's be an entrepreneur. So, and then that's where I started working a lot with startups. And finally, I decided, okay, let's be a VC.
I think you still studied aeronautical, right?
Yes, that was my undergrad is, I first went to IIT Kharagpur and joined BTech in aeronautical engineering. And the idea was to learn how to become, I was quite excited. I'll learn rocket science. And then I realized that some of my seniors were, hey, we don't really learn rocket science here. And we don't really know what's happening. Like, oh, so then I gave JE again and went to IIT Delhi in mathematics and computer science. That's what I picked up.
Nice. So then how did you end up in VC?
Oh, it's a nice story. So I came out of IIT Delhi and we were like six guys staying in one three-bedroom apartment, two guys per room. I was roommates with a couple of folks who went on to become the founders of Flipkart. Sachin Bansal and Binny Bansal, you know, we all used to live together. The funny story is that they offered all of us to be the like founding team, come and join them. Nobody joined them. In fact, I went to my father and I was like, hey, you know, these guys are doing something interesting. And he was like, what are you talking? You leave like a $10,000 job, a year job, and go and join the startup. It's not going to pay you anything. And then they came back to us and said, hey, why don't you invest like some money into us? And they're like $2,000, $3,000. And we're like, no, we don't think, at least I said, I don't think it's going to be a big idea. And this was Flipkart, which became Flipkart, right? So one of the biggest misses in my life. So I left Bangalore and I said, you know, I'll go get an international job, went to Singapore, started working, got my MBA. And then as luck would have it, I was working in Singapore. I went back to Singapore after my MBA. And one day I just called up Sachin Bansal, the founder of, and at that time CEO of Flipkart, and said, hey, you know, I have this friend who runs a startup which sells online cosmetics, and he's having a hard time selling from Hong Kong into India. And I was like, you have this small startup called Flipkart, let me connect you to. He said, yeah, I'll have a chat with him. This is great. How have you been? Blah, blah. He said, by the way, there is this investor, Axel, which has invested in my company and they are trying to find an analyst. And are you up for it? Like, I said, like, what exactly is venture capital? You tell me that first. And he's like, okay, they give you money and that's what you do. So like, okay, sounds very interesting. So that's how I ended up starting interviewing with Axel. And generally anybody I asked for, feedback on Axel, everybody said it's a great firm, you should go and join it. So I said, okay, this sounds very, very interesting. And I was very excited that I'll be part of the startup ecosystem. I ended up chatting with Binny, and Binny was still trying to convince me not to join Axel. He said, are you mad? Why will you go and join a VC? Come and join Flipkart and, you know, head a product division or head a division for us. I was like, no, man, like this sounds more interesting. And that's the year when Flipkart became a unicorn. And okay, maybe I should have gone there. So yeah, but I've been with Axel now for 10 years and now it's been a great journey. So,
yeah. So I was going through your tweets and one of the things that you mentioned is that I've realized that the size of the fight in the entrepreneur is bigger than the size of the market in deciding the outcome of a startup. So why do you say that?
Yeah, I think at the time, you know, the startup, anybody starts off a startup, they target a particular market. And once you actually go live and you start going after customers and start solving problems, you know, there are a lot of problems to be solved. So entrepreneur has to keep on fighting all these problems and overcoming them all the time. But at some point of time, you realize that the market was not big enough when you started. So your business is not growing, or you realize that, hey, you know, the problem I started off with is not going to be a very interesting problem when I solve it. So at that point, any entrepreneur realizes it's not worth my time, right? It's not worth the effort I'm putting in. That's, and then they said, okay, if this market is not big enough, let me either expand the market or shift to a completely new market. So that was the intent behind that thing. And I have seen that happen because there are entrepreneurs I have worked with, when they start off, they will start off with a very, very small idea. And then now, like, I'll take the case of Zetwork, which is one of my companies. When they started off with steel manufacturing. So B2B marketplace for contract manufacturing. And now the company has like 20 different business units. And, you know, when I invested, I can tell you very frankly, I didn't think that they will have 20 business units, right? But entrepreneurs, they are like, hey, you know, founders are like, how do we make this bigger and bigger? How do we make it faster and faster? So they're constantly expanding, constantly building out the engine, right? So their fight is much larger than the market they were in earlier.
So you guys invest in a lot of B2B companies, right? So are there any unique customer acquisition or retention strategies that you've seen Axel portfolio companies use that may be beneficial for B2B startups?
I think the most unique strategy which I heard was from Zenoti, which is one of our SaaS companies. So they build software for spas and salons, salon chains. And so he mentioned that what they started doing was they send an iPad loaded with their deck to the buyers and say that, hey, and with a bag of popcorn, right? So, and they say, by the time you finish this popcorn, you can just go through our deck and learn what we do. So let's have a popcorn together, right? Watch a nice movie. And they found a lot of conversion from that. And the very interesting bit was, I mean, they are able to do this. No startup would like to send iPads to a lot of customers. But in this case, they have like they already know the few thousand customers, or like 5,000, 6,000 customers they need. That's it for their business to become big. By, they actually know who the title is, who the decision maker is, how long they've been in that company. So they've mapped that out. So they were able to very, very focusedly market into those organizations. I think that was very, very interesting strategy.
When it comes to enterprise, getting enterprise customer, that's very difficult for a B2B startups, right? So do you have any examples of like your portfolio companies using interesting ways to reach enterprise customers?
I think the first 10 to 15 enterprise customers, and by enterprise customers, I really mean where enterprises are paying you more than $50,000 a year kind of contracts. I think those are not easy to get. Those are hard to get. So the first 5 to 10, you just have to do all sorts of strategies. You know, you fly down, you call up your uncle and aunt. Hey, people have called up other board members, try to like, I'm already talking to this company. Can you write a mail to this board member and say we are a good company and all that? And people have to do it. There's no other ways about it. I mean, in fact, I have my companies where I have a couple of companies which will be in the beginning stages, seed stages, are in the last two final round. Like they're one of the two contenders, and they lose out because finally the purchasing manager or the decision maker says, hey, you're a startup and I'm not really sure. And you know, here's this SAP or here's this Coupa, and just the decision is based on the fact that you might be out of business. So in those particular cases, what we have tried to do is like either me or, you know, someone else who I know in that particular geography as a popular VC or known VC would just call them up or send them a mail, a letter of recommendation. Hey, we are invested in this company, and say, see, Axel, we manage $20 billion. We are invested in this company. This is not a fly-by-night operator. So that has helped a lot. Yeah. The other interesting strategy has been that, you know, typically when companies from Southeast Asia or India have to expand into US or Europe, what people do is people try to find how to hire the sales guy. Some of the best companies have done the best hiring. What they've done is they've gone after hired their older sales guys. And by older, I mean with a lot of experience, people who have retired in the US. They're still willing to work, and you can get them. They are expensive, but you can get them on a part-time basis, and they allow you to expand and ramp up your team very quickly because they have a lot of insight.
They also have a network, probably.
They have a very strong network. They are drinking buddies with some of their clients and customers, and you might get a FaceTime with all their customers very fast. So that's also happening.
Yeah. And one other interesting thing that I saw on your Twitter is that you mentioned that I think product market fit is not measured by metrics like retention and engagement, but more subjective metrics like NPS, which captures customer feedback. I would really like to know why you said that.
I think in my mind, the retention and engagement metrics are really their outcome of what has already happened in the system, right? So you're measuring, this is what my product was. And in my mind, by when I said NPS, I really meant was the customer, people should be talking to their customers regularly and getting that subjective feedback. Why exactly are they using this? Because NPS and engagement, how like people just throw engagement metrics like how many minutes spent per session. It doesn't tell you anything, right? It doesn't, like what did the user do during that time is a lot more important. And, you know, when you start talking to people, you realize you have thought they will use the product in a certain way and they're using it in a completely unique and interesting way, which you wouldn't have thought of, right? So we had this company which was building products for, you know, if you have a prepaid plan, they will help you manage the prepaid plan. And they had this product in which you could actually see who all has called you. Prepaid plans typically don't tell you which numbers called you so much, right? Singtel doesn't give it that much, right? So you just eat and then you don't know where your money went, right? So they were actually tracking all of that. And then they opened a new feature, which was you could track what your family members were also using it for. And suddenly we saw a lot of people using it for that feature. And we were like, okay, this is very interesting. We cracked something because we are allowing people to save money for their family members. Then we spoke to a bunch of users and what turned out interestingly, husbands were trying to figure out who their wife is talking to. Wives were figuring out. So it was like, we never imagined that would be the use case people will try to figure it out for. But tells you customer behavior, right? So on the paper, engagement was high. On the paper, retention was high. But if we hadn't spoken to customers and figured out why you're using it, we wouldn't have figured it out.
Yeah. I guess when you get feedbacks like that, you can actually segment the customer and then figure out ways to how you can provide more value and stuff.
Yeah.
To them, right? Yeah. So now let's talk about Axel Atoms a little bit. So what is the program and why should startup apply for Axel Atoms, maybe instead of maybe Sequoia Surge? And
hey, you know, there are a lot of interesting programs in the ecosystem today. So you have Y Combinator, you have Sequoia Surge, you have our program, Axel Atoms as well, right? In our case, we are really going and trying to help companies which are just starting off, right? So in the first set of applications, we have chosen a bunch of companies, which where if you see, it's just two people and an idea, essentially, and a lot of companies like that. And we have companies in crypto, we have companies in brands, we have SaaS companies, fintech companies, developer tools. But the core genesis of Axel Atoms is that when somebody thinks of starting a company, they need a lot of help. And we have the DNA in Axel to help companies to building out from seed to scale, right? So that's what we do. A lot of these companies, which have, I have funded so many companies where it was just paper plan. And at least all of us get a lot of excitement and fun when we see, backing somebody which we think can make it big and see their path grow. So Axel Atoms is a program where we are giving $250,000 uncapped convertible to startups who apply and then get selected into the program. And then we allow companies to raise, even if they want, up to $2 million from other investors, or it could be the other way. They've already raised, let's say, $1.5 million, or they've raised $500,000 or even $200,000 and they want, they think Axel Atoms is a good fit for them. And if we like them, then we could go in and work with them and invest the $250,000 with them. The best part is since it's an uncapped convertible, they don't need to do any dilution right now. So dilution happens in the next round valuation. So you might be diluting 10% for your $1 million right now, but if you take our $250,000, you're not diluting additional 5% for it. That will only happen in the next round and at the next price. So it will not even 5%, it will be less than that. So that's what we are trying to do fundamentally with Axel Atoms.
Yeah.
So this allows fuel for the startup without any dilution to build the product, essentially, right?
So do you have a framework for screening and selecting startups for Axel Atoms program? You can always say VCs always say this, I invest people with just a plan and just a team.
Yeah, yeah.
But then that team specifically might be a experienced team who has done or had success in the past, right? So
Yeah, it's an interesting question. All VCs say that we invest in people and plan, paper plan. So what's special? What's the selection criteria? In my case, there are five questions I ask. I call it the five whys, right? So first and foremost is why this team? know, is this passionate about this area? Do they have a special insight? Do I feel they have the grit to be able to continue on? And when problems will come, they will continue to break through those problems. I think those are some of the qualifications I need for why is the team. Second is, why is this the right time, right, for this business? Right? So, you know, you could have a great team and everything, but is there something big which is happening, some inflection happening at this point of time? Like crypto happened, so many crypto companies got created. So similarly, like, is there some unique trend which is going to happen, which will sustain for next 10 years, because of which this becomes interesting, right? So first you look at the team and you say, it's an interesting team, I want to back it. And you say, okay, this team could do 10,000 things, but they picked up this particular thing to do. So why is it the right time for it to happen? Then you go look at how big can it be? So why is it going to be a big thing, right? What they've picked up. So is it a large market? Is it growing fast? Are they going to take away money from existing customers, or some net new spending is going to happen? So that is the other why which we have to answer, right? Then the fourth why is this a defensible business? Because, you know, Axel is going to fund it. 10 other VCs are going to look at it and say, hey, interesting category, interesting market. Maybe we should also fund something in that business, right? So we have, like, for example, we have funded 15 to 16 B2B marketplaces. And now if you look in, we invested like 5 years ago. And now if you look, like, almost every other VC has a B2B marketplace in their portfolio, right? And so that's the other bit. So why is this business defensible? Whatever you do, somebody else will copy. So there has to be some defensibility in the business. What is that, right? And then the final question is, you know, why am I the right VC to fund this company? I think that also becomes very important, right? And this is what I try to tell a lot of entrepreneurs now. I mean, and this fifth question wasn't present in my vocabulary 3-4 years ago. What I've realized is each VC has a superpower, just like founders have superpowers, right? Okay. So a typical job of a VC is to help the company in hiring, help the company in raising funding, help the company in introduction to new customers. So with my years of experience and my network, can I help this particular company in getting successful, at least in some of these things, right? So am I the right VC for this startup as well? Now, I might not be the right VC, I'll invest, but the founders are so great that they will be able to, you know, just do it without me as well. So which is also fine. I mean, I'm enabling capital for them. So this is the 5-why framework. Basically, team, why is this the correct team? Why is this the right time? Why is it the right market to become a big company? Why is the business defensible? And why am I the right VC? I mean, those are the questions.
A lot of startups, do they have any choice or like really picking VCs? I mean, unless you're experienced or savvy founders.
Okay, so you're right. I mean, depends on the ecosystem, right? So the US ecosystem, there's a lot of choice. There's a lot of VCs, a lot of money, there's a lot of super angels. I think that's starting to happen in India today, and it will happen in Southeast Asia as well, right? Simply because, so that is first, like, it's just a matter of ecosystem. More liquidity in the markets allow you to choose which money you are going to take. Second, depending on the, so you might not have a choice in the first seed or pre-seed round or angel round. You're going to take money from wherever it gets. But as you prove yourself, right, as the market, as you prove yourself, your business, as you grow, then you can be more discerning. Okay, I don't want to take money from this VC because I don't think they will add value over what I have in the cap table. And I have founders who have done that. Who are like, okay, you know, they didn't have any choice in the beginning. They took money from us or others. And then let's say the business didn't do well. So again, we put more money, right? So because nobody else was willing to put money in the business, right? But now they are at a stronger wicket. They have, like, they've proven their base. And so at that time, they can choose, hey, I don't want to take this. And it could be for various reasons, right? So it could be like, first of all, the VC is wanting to give you money. The terms are just bad. Like, they want liquidity preference. They want, you know, ratchet, all those things. So you just don't take those VC. Like, even a company that's not doing good should not take that kind of money. It just destroys the cap table. Then second is, you realize that this particular VC is putting money because he doesn't have a conviction, because these other good VCs, Axel has put money. So this VC is saying, hey, I'll also come and put money, right? Again, you know, when the times are going to be bad, then they are just going to run away. So you need VCs who are putting money with full conviction into the business, that I like the entrepreneur and I like this team. And even if, you know, things go bad, I think I'll stick with this, right? So that's the other piece of it, right? So I think there are things you need to think through before. And then there are people who just come in with high valuations, but they will not really help you out. So, and company building is a process in which the board can help you a lot and can give you directions, right? So you want your VC partner to be somebody who can partner with you and help you grow the business. So, but yes, in the early stages, you might not have that choice. But once you prove yourself, then don't sell yourself short.
So one other thing regarding the defensibility. So let's take an example, right? 100.ms, is that a company that Accelerate invested in?
Yes, 100ms. That's right.
I've seen a competitor company, right? Diet, D-Y-T-E, I think. It's funded by Nexus Venture Partners. Both of them offer like similar solutions. Then,
so very interestingly, even before these companies existed, there was this company called Agora, which went IPO, Agora.io. So what all the three companies do is they provide video infrastructure layer for apps to, and they provide APIs and infrastructure for people to include video streaming or video use cases inside their apps. Now, the interesting bit is there are 2-3 parts. So purely on technology bit, any company which has, this is a technology play, how good your infrastructure is, how good your latency is, infrastructure and technology play. So you could have multiple companies, you know, just like you have multiple electric vehicle companies with differing technologies. Somebody is using LiDAR, somebody is using something else, right? So, and then customers, so that is the first bit. So if you have a unique technology, you could be, which is better than everybody else, you could build out a better thing, right? So for example, 100ms was started off that Agora is too expensive for some use cases or product geography. We'll create same experience, but at cheaper cost. So they have to do technology innovations to have lower bandwidth and the like. So that is one. Two is what kind of workflow or use, or let's say even if you're a developer tool, what kind of APIs, what kind of documentation, how easy is it to use for somebody else? Like, I'm not a developer, right? So can you provide almost like a no-code tool API, no-code way of making using your API, or is it going to be something else? So there are enough ways in which you can differentiate in a market. Now, to your point, why do three companies in that market exist? So market is huge, right? If it is going to be, let's say, at least $50 to $100 billion worth of video streaming market, then you know you can have multiple companies in that space. I don't think that's a problem.
So this is something that a lot of people are probably eager to hear. What is the B2B thesis of Axel India specifically?
So we started investing in B2B, I think in 2012, almost 9 years ago. So we invested in Power to SME, which was at that time, steel, coal, and a lot of other commodities exchange, B2B marketplace. And then since then, we have invested in over 15 B2B marketplaces in agriculture commodities, in contract manufacturing, in fashion, in seafood. So there's a whole host of variety of companies like that. I mean, when we were investing, our thought process was that usually consumer companies are very heavily contested and there are not really any moats. So it's just capital wins. And we were trying to find more capital efficient businesses. And we felt that, you know, if you look at the economy, there's this huge, big need that you are solved. So VCs typically invest behind consumer consumption. And then you have B2B consumption. So businesses also require products just like, you know, any consumer, right? So we said, okay, what are those needs? And are those big markets? And then we went and saw, oh yeah, these are big markets. Like, you know, somebody has to build a road, they need cement. Somebody has to build bridges, they need all the steel. So, and these buildings and bridges, aren't going to build themselves, right? These businesses require services and products, both of them, right? So we started looking at those markets, and then we found that they are huge. Like if you look at, for example, Bizongo does packaging and fashion. Like those two markets alone are like $150 billion in just in India, spent by businesses, right? So, and then so you could basically sell raw materials, you could sell solutions, you could sell design services, testing services, automation, a lot of those services to them, and you could make a healthy margin. So very large market, and healthy margins are possible. And the structure of the market, at least in India, and I think in Indonesia is very similar, is very, very fragmented, very, very small supply base, very small manufacturers. So what you could do is you need an intermediary who can allow for quality assurance, who can probably even consolidate a bunch of these and provide services. So that's where we are investing in. And over the period of time, we have also realized we don't want to invest in trading businesses, which are basically buying from somewhere else and just without adding any value, just selling, like buying cheap and selling expensive. You know, that
arbitrage. Arbitrage. Yeah.
It's a very, very small moat. It's not defensible. So defensibility comes by adding some value in the whole supply chain. So it could even be financing, which is difficult to do, but you have to add some value. So it's not just movement of goods.
Yeah. But then you have also mentioned that it's all about the founders still.
Right.
So
right.
If you could just elaborate on that.
Yeah. So what has happened is, at least if you look at some of our companies, let's say Zwork founders, So Zetwork, one of the founders whose father used to be in that contract manufacturing business of his own. So, and he was a small manufacturer, so he knew the problems his father faced, and he was kind of, okay, this is interesting in a market. If my father has this problem, a lot of others have this problem, and he knew that it could be big. So they had this intuitive sense of the problems. And similarly, if you go look at CocoPort, which is one of our other companies. So Purnendu was a CEO of this company called Kunal Nagal, one of the largest freight forwarders in the world. And he said, hey, you know, this process can be more efficient. And so he decided to make that freight forwarding process transparent and efficient. Then, you know, so what I'm coming at is a lot of people have relevant experience in that space or have by first connection, know somebody who has had that problem and they think about it and say, I can solve this problem. Then there are people like other folks who see that problem. Let's say Fashionza founder. So one of the Fashionza founders, he used to work in a online D2C fashion brand. And then he saw, okay, these guys have a lot of problem in procurement of fashion. It was not coming on time. Quality is not great. So he said, okay, let me solve this problem. Right. So these are, what I'm trying to come at is smart founders have looked at various problems in their life or people they know and help them. And then said, okay, is this a large enough problem for me? And that's where they get the inspiration to build this business. Right. None of them are like Punendu is a unique personality. And for example, Anil from Samunnati, who does agri supply chain financing and agri trading, he's also from that industry. He knows about that industry, right? So they had experienced hands. But there are enough B2B marketplaces started off by young 28, 30-year-old, you know, folks who have built large businesses. So I think it's just about being analytical and trying to identify why this industry will work for me.
Yeah. I think that could be an advantage also at some point because you have a beginner's mind and then I think you can learn in 3-4 months, right? Where are the opportunities? Where are the inefficiencies and stuff?
Correct.
Yes. And quickly going back to Axel Atoms, do you guys have planned to expand it to Southeast Asia?
Oh, yeah. So thanks for bringing that up. So come March of 22, we are going to start accepting applications. Then we are going to do a launch in Southeast Asia as well. We want to have companies from that region apply to us. So yeah, 100%.
Awesome. How do you see VCs changing, venture capital?
These are very interesting and exciting times. You know, I've been VC for 10 years plus and something or the other new comes up, right? So crowdfunding came up as for seed some like 5-6 years ago. Then came rolling funds, which is an innovation done by AngelList. Now then crypto took off and ICOs became a norm at that time. So something or the other keeps showing up. And now like super angels, it used to be a phenomenon in the US. It's happening in India. It's happening in Southeast Asia as well. So now you see incubators, accelerators, early stage programs. So what we are really seeing is something or the other new is coming up all the time. And the way VC will change, I think what I've seen is in 10 years at least is people are much more receptive of innovation and people are going after giving more and more money to entrepreneurs. So this is probably the golden age for entrepreneurship is what I feel. There's so many opportunities. And I think more importantly, smart folks are beginning to look at entrepreneurship as a career choice, not as a, I don't know what will happen over there. And societal changes happen. Like each country now, parents are like, you could do your startup. You could have that conversation at the dinner table, right?
Yeah.
Because there is money available. And so more and more smarter people are going to come and who are going to come up with newer ways of getting money and who are going to create new business models. And VCs are going to be there to support them. There's enough capital available. I think for the next at least 10, 20 years, I don't see any problem happening there.
Yeah. So, can we get to a stage in India where, you know, just like you have this mutual fund ads all the time, there are ads where you can invest in startups. I mean, that's the best possible scenario, right?
Yeah, that's a thought like which my marketing team also asks me, why don't we take out full page ads and Netflix ads on YouTube, why they should come to Axel. I think it's going to be hard. I don't think that's going to happen simply because that's a very heavy cost and finding the entrepreneurs, right? So, you know, if you do an ad like that, you come take money from me, millions of people will apply and they might not be the relevant set. That's why you've not seen it happen. So
yeah, but I was asking more like getting more in. So people can invest in a lot of things, right? Like stocks and mutual funds and whatnot.
Right,
so
yeah.
Making it easy for a lot more people.
Oh, that's happening. I think that's 100% happening in India. The only catch in that is, see, the government regulators and market regulators are cognizant of the fact that VC is a risk category, right? So Like 9 out of 10 companies will fail. So the risk that you lose your money is very high. And two, the fact that this is an illiquid asset, right? So once you invest in a fund, you get your money back maybe after 8 years or 10 years or maybe even 13 years sometimes. So, you know, if you open it up to retail investors, it's a new product, they will not understand it. So the government, at least in India, what they've done is you need to have a certain net worth and you need to have a minimum amount of investment. I think it's like $80,000 before you are eligible to invest in a VC fund in India, right? So that is happening. So it's definitely a lot more. Maybe it will happen at $10,000 and to retail investors also. I mean, people are asking, like a lot of my friends who are from, they are doing angel investing. And angel investing you can do, which is open to anybody actually. Like this, you can just go to Let's Venture in India or AngelList and just start investing through it. Nobody's stopping people from doing that. But people need to understand the risk. So,
yeah. Okay. So in your opinion, what kind of startups you think India is not ready for at the moment? I had deep tech startups in mind. So,
okay. Yeah, I think deep tech is interesting. So first of all, I personally feel that almost any kind of startup in India is possible. But there are certain type of companies which will get funded from VCs. And those are companies which can become big. Now, let me qualify big, right? So I typically tell like my companies, can you get to 100 million revenue in, let's say, 6 to 7 years? That is the ask. The assumption is if you get there, you will be a couple of $1 billion in valuation. Now, an example of which companies which I think won't get there is, for example, let's say luxury product companies. A luxury product company getting to a startup, getting to a couple of hundred million in revenues, their revenues is hard in a market like India. So that kind of pattern doesn't fit, right? The other set of companies, and coming to deep tech startups, I think deep tech startups are very different from, and by deep tech, I mean things like, let's say, space tech, biotech, medical device innovation, right? What ends up happening is there is a research period. So there is a period in which you have to make and develop the technology. And by the way, we have invested in biotech startups, for example. So we understand that. But this is a game of patience. You'll take probably 5 to 6 years after which you will know the technology is working. And because you're funding experiments till that point of time. And once the technology is working, then you can have to build the business to start commercializing it. So, and it takes a lot of money. So some startups take a lot of money to figure that out, right? So for example, if you were to launch, you are doing a rocket launching startup and you are creating a rocket launcher, it requires you $10 to $15 million to figure out whether your rocket works or not, right? And then you say, okay, now I can go to customers and start selling. So that $10 to $15 million is a very large amount of ticket size to know whether success is going to happen. So not all VCs can write it. Market where there's a lot of liquidity and there's that risk appetite is there, you will find people willing to take that risk. So in India, for example, the deep tech VCs which have happened around artificial intelligence and blockchain, and some have done the satellite tech companies as well. But broadly, so long gestation period is what is not in sync with deep tech startups today, is what I feel. But yes, we are starting to look at that space more and more. So you need patient capital, which has longer gestation period. Like I was telling you, get to 100 million in 6 years for regular startup, right? I don't think that's going to happen in deep tech that fast.
So. Yeah. So do you think India as a country, we invest enough in research and development? We are not as research focused when you compare to the US or the UK or even China, right? So that means that we will not have founders who are capable of doing like a deep technically, solving deep technical problems. Am I right to say that? Or
no, I don't agree with that statement. See, a lot of deep tech startups are existing in India. There's a lot of support from educational institutes in India. The IITs of the world have, IITs of India have actually incubated a lot of these companies. And if you go look at a lot of the international, like let's say take US companies, right? A lot of innovation is being done by Indian origin PhD students, Indian origin software engineers, right? And I feel that they are starting to come back to India or doing startups here. In fact, like there was this statistics which was going around a couple of weeks ago that at one point of time, 60% of Indian IIT students used to emigrate. Now that number has dropped to 5%.
Yeah.
Right. So that's, I think, the important sign. We just don't see it yet. Right. So it is that ecosystem is building. We're starting to see hardware accelerators happen in India. We're starting to see these space tech companies fund in India. I think that just deep tech takes a period. It might not happen in the next 10 years, but it'll happen definitely in the next 20 years is what I believe, right? It will happen. It's just the pace will keep on increasing. And the government is supporting all of this, right? So,
yeah. Quick, one more question. So in terms of pure dollars spent on research, right? We are far behind than US and China, right?
Yes.
So, and if you want to be like a technological leader, do you think that can happen without that spend?
No, I don't think it can happen without that kind of spend, for sure. So that money has to come either from the government or it has to come from privates. And I think to some extent, VCs bridge that gap, but we don't do it to the scale of changing it at a national level, right? So it's because we are really talking about companies and technologies can be commercialized today or in a very short time. Whereas the research has to be driven over like long periods. So I think that spend is definitely required.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've read this like this self-driving program from MIT Media Lab that happened in 1970s. And you still...
Yeah. Now see, the good part is that India is coming late to the party, which basically means we have already learned from a lot of mistakes of others, right? So we can come up with a better design, which we get to the results faster. Like, for example, take Mangalyaan, right, which is the Indian Mars project. It created the rocket at 1/10 the price of NASA.
A NASA project, yeah.
Right. So those kind of things are bound to happen, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a pro and a con, but yes, we can get frustrated by the fact that not enough dollars are there, but hey, we are still a developing country. So,
yeah. Yeah. So, what are Axel's plan for Southeast Asia?
So, you know, we are very excited about Indonesia and Vietnam and Thailand. And we've done a bunch of investments over the last 1.5 years. We've deployed, I think, close to, I would say, $150 odd million in the last 1.5 years in the geography across 4 to 5 deals. A couple of them have been growth deals. And we intend to do a lot more. So we will, starting next year, you will see us being very active with the ATOMS program in Southeast Asia. We plan to do a lot of growth checks as well as a lot of seed and Series A. I think overall, probably in a year, we will end up doing 10 to 12 deals, at least investments in that geography. At least that's what I can say right now. But to be honest, I think if it's a good company, I don't think there are any restrictions. Axel is a global fund. We manage over $20 billion and we will deploy capital to the best companies anywhere in the world.
This has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Rahul.
If you like this podcast, please follow Understanding VC wherever you're listening to this and also share it with folks who might be interested. Thank you.